All of us grew up with the nursery rhyme, Humpty Dumpty. But did you know that it was once a riddle? Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. And all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty Dumpty back together again. This past week, when I learned that once upon a time this little rhyme posed a question to be answered, I discovered to my embarrassment that I couldn't even figure out what the question was. Do you know what the question is? The question is, what is Humpty Dumpty? Now, why is that so hard to figure out? Why is that expected to be some kind of a riddle? Our difficulty is because we live on this side of history. And on this side of history, the answer to the riddle is more widely known than the riddle itself, because it is given away in all of our nursery books. The answer is just given away right from the get-go, because Humpty Dumpty is pictured as an egg. Now, he has arms, he has legs, he has a face, but he's an egg. So the answer to the riddle, then, we're asking, what is Humpty Dumpty? Oh, it's an egg. The egg fell off. The egg couldn't be put back together again. Now, as believers, we face a similar problem when we come to the text of Scripture. Because we live on this side of history, the revelation of the mystery of Gentile inclusion into the promises is more widely known than the mystery is. But as our text today will show, it was not always perceived as that way. It was something to be revealed. It was something to be discovered. Now, so far, we've been introduced to the king in our text. His name is Jesus. And we've been introduced to Humpty Dumpty, the nation of Israel, mainly pictured as the scribes and the Pharisees. But we still haven't been introduced to one major player, one major group that appears throughout the Gospels. It's the king's men, or as you know them, the disciples. Now, who are the disciples, and why do we care? What is their ministry, and does it have any relevance for us today, now that we too have the Spirit? Are they still relevant for us today? And we're going to try to answer these questions in our text today in Matthew chapter 10. So if you want to go ahead and turn there, and we are going to find in Matthew chapter 10 the second of five major discourses in the book of Matthew. Now, the first one we called the King's Speech. It's commonly known as the Sermon on the Mount, and that appeared in chapters 5 through 7, where Jesus showed up as the king. He gave his message, which was simply that entrance into the kingdom is going to come by imputed righteousness that one gets through asking. Accounted to you righteousness. Reckoned to you righteousness. His righteousness. He is the righteousness of God. You need it to get into the kingdom. How do you get it? You ask. You ask, seek, knock, and you will find that righteousness. This second discourse, we could call the king's commission. We could call the message to the king's men. Some people like to call it the sermon to Israel. Just look at it. We're going to find it in Matthew 10, but we're going to walk up to it starting in verse 35 of chapter 9. So if you look at Matthew 9, 35, right at the end of that chapter, we find Jesus was going through all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues, and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom, and healing every kind of disease and every kind of sickness. Seeing the people, he felt compassion for them because they were distressed and dispirited, like sheep without a shepherd. Jesus is traveling through these cities, and it says he's proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom, to which I ask, what is the gospel of the kingdom? When we think of the word gospel, of course, you know, we're thinking of that Greek word euangelion. It just means good news. We're familiar with that. But do you recall what we're talking about when we think of the term kingdom? We spoke of it a little bit. It's not defined in the Gospels, but it is expected, it is anticipated throughout the Old Testament. When we're thinking of the kingdom, we are thinking, in the words of Jesus, we are thinking of God's will being done on earth as it is in heaven. And that is going to happen by God executing His rule over the nations through the Davidic king, the Christ, from Jerusalem. His will is going to be done on earth as it is in heaven, and it's going to be executed through His king. That's what we're thinking about. So what then would be this good news of the kingdom? What is Jesus preaching? Well, as you recall in chapter 3, John the Baptist showed up, that voice crying out in the wilderness, and his message was, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand." And then in chapter 4, John was taken into prison, and Jesus picked up the message, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand." And this good news now that Jesus is preaching, is that the kingdom is presently at hand. That's what it is. The kingdom is presently near. The kingdom is presently available due to the presence of the king. The good news is that the wait is over. It is right here, standing before you in the flesh, waiting for you to accept it. Now, how could Israel know that the kingdom was presently available? Because Jesus said so? Because John said so? No. They would know because Jesus was able to perform isolated demonstrations of His authority. He could heal the sick. He could calm storms. He could cast out demons, those gods of the nations. He could raise the dead. So Jesus was able to demonstrate that He could remove the curses, both the curses on the nation, I'm thinking Deuteronomy 28, the curse on creation, Genesis 3, He can remove those. He can deliver them from Rome, the time of the Gentiles, these people that are ruling over, dominating Israel. He can remove them, no problem. Look, He can remove their gods. And He can, of course, deliver Israel. He can resurrect them into the kingdom. Jesus demonstrates all this, and these miracles that He's performing are just validating His authority. It's validating His work. He comes and he gives His message, His words, and then He performs His works. So His words and His works pair together and agree with the Old Testament. So we know that He is indeed the one that we've been looking for. This is the one that we've been expecting. He's not just calming a storm so that the 20th century American Christian can know that Jesus can calm the storms of your life. That is not what He's doing here. He's doing it to validate His message to the nation of Israel. Notice it, verse 36. He sees the people. He feels compassion for them because they're distressed. They're dispirited. They're like sheep without a shepherd. A buddy of mine would say that they're like a room full of two-year-olds with no supervision. So they're knocking things over. They're knocking each other over. Tears are coming out. They need somebody to care for them. And Jesus then pulls His disciples aside and He tells them, verse 37, "The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Therefore, beseech the Lord of the harvest to send out workers into His harvest." And now notice this. Look at chapter 10, verse 1. Jesus summoned His 12 disciples. And then look at verse 5. These 12 disciples Jesus sent out. Now that was quick. Ask the Lord of the harvest to send out workers. Okay, answer. Gathers 12, sends them out. That's what's taking place here. He takes His 12 aside. He sends them out into the harvest. Now, who are these guys? Who are these men that Jesus is sending to do His work? Well, just let's start back in chapter 10, verse 1. Jesus summons the 12, and He gives them authority over unclean spirits to cast them out. and to heal every kind of disease and every kind of sickness. Now, the names of the 12 apostles are these. The first, Simon, who is called Peter, and Andrew, his brother, and James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, Philip, and Bartholomew, Thomas, and Matthew, the tax collector, James, the son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus, Simon the Zealot, and Judas Iscariot, spoiler alert, the one who betrayed him. These guys, these 12 apostles, are they Jews or are they Gentiles? Or is it a mix? Yeah, they're Jews. Do they have first-hand knowledge of Jesus' words, of his message? Yeah, you might recall when Jesus began his first discourse, the Sermon on the Mount, the King's Speech in Matthew chapter 5, verse 1, the very first verse says, when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up to the mountain, and after he sat down, his disciples came to him. So they have first-hand eyewitness testimony to Jesus' words. But then you recall, they also have eyewitness testimony then of his works. Because chapter 8 and 9, those events immediately follow Jesus' message on the Sermon on the Mount. He gives the sermon, and then he says, all right, I'm hungry, let's go to Peter's house and let's have lunch. And on his way to Peter's house, all kinds of people are coming to him, and he's healing them. You think of the leper that came, and he responds to Jesus' message. Lord, you can make me clean. Boom, you got it. Or the centurion that comes, this Gentile, this Roman soldier who says, look, I got a servant home. I know how authority works. If you want, he can be healed. Well, you heal him. You got it. Boom. He's doing these miracles on the way to lunch. So did these disciples witness his works? Yes. They were there for chapter 5 through 7. They were there for chapter 8 through 9. So they are eyewitnesses to the words and the works of Jesus. And the king picks them out, these 12 Jewish disciples, who we call the apostles, and he gives them special authority. All right, they can do things we can't just go out and do. They're casting out the gods of the nations. They're healing the sick anytime they want. It's a demonstration. They have the authority to do it. And we'll say more about this in a moment, but just for now, note that he is equipping them to carry out a very special mission. Now, what is this mission? What is the commission that Jesus is preparing them for? He's going to tell us, verse 5. These 12, Jesus sent out after instructing them, do not go in the way of the Gentiles, and do not enter any city of the Samaritans, but rather go to the lost sheep, the word is perishing there, to the perishing sheep of the house of Israel. And as you go, preach, saying the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse the lepers, cast out demons. Freely you received, freely give. Jesus tells them, do not go to the Gentiles. Do not go to the Samaritans. My Jesus said that? My Jesus said that. Now, for some reason, this text has not found its way into our evangelistic messages. We don't really like to use this verse for our missions conferences. I wonder why. We like the one that says, make disciples of all nations. That's Matthew 28. Matthew 10 comes before Matthew 28. In Matthew 10, he says, don't you go to the Gentiles. And the word, by the way, when we go to Matthew 28, make disciples of all the nations, it's ethne. It's the same word that's used here that says, do not go to the Gentiles. And it probably means the same thing in both places, which is non-Jews. So he's saying, don't go to the non-Jews. Matthew 28, he says, go make disciples of the non-Jews, the nations. Here he does not say that. The king's men, these Jewish apostles, they're to go, verse 6, only to the perishing sheep of Israel. And I ask, what is Jesus doing here? That is a very strange thing that for us, I guess, to come to and say, I'm a Gentile. I know I have the message. What's he doing? Well, consider this. How many books in the Old Testament were written to Gentiles? Zero. Now, we have some books like Obadiah, and we think, well, that's a condemnation against Edom. We don't know that they ever got it, because it's in the Jewish Bible. No books in the Old Testament were written to Gentiles. Who is the revelation entrusted to? Israel. That's what Paul's going to say. What advantage does the Jew have in Romans chapter 3? He said, great in every respect. We were entrusted with the oracles of God. We had the revelation of Messiah given to us. Now remember, this nation was created for a very specific purpose in the story. All the way back in Genesis chapter 12, God plucks up one man from Ur of the Chaldees, a pagan, a guy who's worshiping the moon god. His name is Abram. He plucks him up and he makes him a promise. He's going to be the father of a great nation, and in him, all the families of the earth will be blessed. All the nations of the earth will be blessed. So this nation was supposed to take this message that's going to be given to this one Abram and on through him, take the message of Messiah, and their commission is to bring it to the Gentiles. But the problem we saw when we went through the Old Testament is that Israel won't even accept the message for themselves. They do not accept the message. So time after time, prophets are sent to them, trying to get them to turn back, to return to the Lord. They reject the message. They're not having it. They want to hang out with the Gentiles. They like their stuff. They like their women. They like their gods. They can't be a blessing to the Gentiles when they're out there running with the Gentiles, when they're serving the gods of the Gentiles. But now, here Jesus shows up in the New Testament. And he comes with the message of Messiah. The king brings the message of Messiah. I'm here. And where is he going to go? When he comes with the message, where is the king going to go? To Israel. He's going to bring the message to Israel. Why is he going to do that? Well, because they still are supposed to perform their function. They're supposed to take the message to the nations. So the king is bringing the message to Israel so that Israel will say, okay, great, receive it. Now let's go tell the nations. Now, are they going to accept the message of the king? Well, let's think about the Old Testament. Did they accept the message before the king was here? No. Why? Because they're a wicked people with a bad heart. An uncircumcised heart. So, are they going to accept the message now that the king is here? Probably not. Why? Because they are still a wicked people with an uncircumcised heart. They need a new heart. Now, what is this message then that these 12 apostles, the king's men, are going to take only to the perishing sheep of Israel? What is this message? Verse 7. The kingdom of heaven is at hand. So it was the message of John the Baptist. It becomes the message of Jesus, which is now to be the message of Jesus' apostles. These 12 Jewish men are to go to Israel and proclaim that, look, the kingdom is at hand. It's near. It's available in the form of the king. And then they demonstrate it. Verse 8. Heal the sick. Raise the dead. Cleanse the lepers. Cast out demons. Do those things that I was doing in chapters 8 and 9 to validate my message. Go and do these signs that point to the availability of the kingdom. And then point back to the king who gave you this authority. You remember when you were in school and you had show and tell? I remember. Now, I'm sure that they have like all kinds of restrictions now, But when I was growing up, I don't remember any of those. It must have been a very terrifying day for the teachers. What in the world are these kids going to bring? But the idea of show and tell, right? I'm bringing something, and then I am telling everybody about it. The disciples here, their job is to go throughout the cities of Israel and show and tell. Do the signs, tell them about the king that's here. This is how we have the authority, because he has the authority. They're to be witnesses of Jesus' words and his works, so that the nation can believe, return, and then bring that message to the nation. That's what's going on here. Now, how's this thing supposed to go down? Verse 9. Jesus says, "Do not acquire gold or silver or copper for your money belts, or a bag for your journey, or even two coats or sandals or a staff, for the worker is worthy of his support. And whatever city or village you enter, inquire who is worthy in it, and stay at his house until you leave that city. As you enter the house, give it your greeting. If the house is worthy, give it your blessing of peace. But if it is not worthy, take back your blessing of peace. Whoever does not receive you nor heed your words as you go out of that house or that city, shake the dust off of your feet. Truly I say to you, it will be more tolerable for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah in the day of judgment than for that city." Jesus says, don't take any extra money. I don't want you to take any extra clothes. Don't take any supplies. Leave the backpack. Leave the suitcase at home. Get gone. Why? You know, we don't tell our missionaries that, do we? They come back and they say, we need some help. We need some support, because it's rough out there. Because the world, they don't necessarily receive the message. We're going into enemy territory, and we need some artillery support. We need some reinforcements. Jesus says, no, no. Take the clothes on your back and go take this message out. Why? Because according to Jesus, the people's reception of the apostles' message is going to be evident by the hospitality that they show them. It's about hospitality. If they show you hospitality, it's because they're identifying with you and your message. So he tells them, look, when you go to these homes, if they receive you, they're going to provide for all of your needs and send you on your way. They're going to give you a hot and a cot, and then the next day you're on to the next one. Now, is this some form of a social gospel? You know, we treat somebody kindly, and because we do good stuff for them, we get into the kingdom? Is that what's happening here? Well, you know, I come from Mississippi, which is the hospitality state. And while that's really good, you know, showing hospitality to people is good, I'm pretty sure that the percentage of people getting into the kingdom from Mississippi is about the same as the percentage of people getting into the kingdom from Texas. So what's going on? This isn't just hospitality to anyone. This is hospitality to certain ones, to the king's men. You're identifying with the king's men, these anointed ones who are bringing God's message. And he's not talking about your preacher here, by the way. You can have me over to your house and feed me a meal and play some canasta with me. That's not going to get you into the kingdom. I'm not God's anointed like he's God's anointed. Okay? Notice what's happening here. This is something that is not exactly new. We've seen this before. We've seen it before a lot. And if you were to go back to Genesis with this idea in mind now, you're going to find it everywhere you go, all the way from start to finish. Think about the destruction, since he just mentioned Sodom. It's going to be more tolerable for Sodom than for you guys. What happened in Sodom and Gomorrah? The angels come to Lot, and what does he do? He takes them in. He shows hospitality to them. Many consider the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah. What's the first thing we think about? Homosexuality. And there's no doubt that they're in violation in that regard, that homosexuality is wrong and these people are committing these acts. But is that the issue that's supposed to be in the forefront in the story for Sodom and Gomorrah. Consider what the prophet Ezekiel says. This is Ezekiel 16. I'll just read it for you. You don't have to turn there. But this is Ezekiel chapter 16, verse 49. Behold, this was the guilt of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters had arrogance, abundant food, and careless ease, but she did not help the poor and needy. Thus they were haughty and committed abominations before me. Therefore I removed them when I saw it. They did not show hospitality. Now, lest we think that, well, maybe it started that way and it just went to homosexuality and that was ultimately the problem. That issue popped up again, didn't it? Remember Judges? It happened again in the book of Judges. You might remember the men of Gibeah. The Levite comes to Gibeah. And who gets assaulted in that story? Is it a man? It's his concubine. So if the issue is an issue of homosexuality, you would expect it to pop up in both instances. It doesn't. That's not the issue. That is an issue. Make no mistake. It is not the issue. The problem, the thing that brought destruction on the city, is that the city disregarded the messenger of the Lord. They had no regard for these angelic messengers that brought the message of destruction to the people. Lot shows them hospitality because he recognizes who they are. He bows down to them when he sees them. In the book of Exodus, when Israel is traveling to the promised land and they come across Moab, Moab refuses to show them hospitality. Because of that, listen to what Moses writes. This is Deuteronomy 23, verse 4. No Moabite shall enter the assembly of the Lord, because they did not meet you with food and water on the way when you came out of Egypt. Israel had the message of Messiah. Moab didn't show them hospitality. I'll bless those that bless you. I'll curse those that curse you. He's the one that's carrying this message. He's the anointed one of God. Nabal. Remember David went to Nabal, whose name means fool, to try to get refreshment for him and his men, and he refuses? He dies. Remember at the end of 2 Samuel, David's mighty men. We talked about this when we were in that chapter. There are all kinds of crazy things that these mighty men did. They were bad dudes. Some of them single-handedly kill hundreds and hundreds of people in a single battle. Some of them kill famous people. Some of them kill crazy beasts in crazy situations. But none of them attained to the honor of the three. What did the three do? They went and got David a cup of water from the well at Bethlehem. They refreshed God's anointed. That's it? That's it. And it is huge. When we get to Matthew chapter 25, towards the end of this book, Jesus is going to talk about the sheep and the goats. And in that discourse, he's going to tell the people that when they gave a group he calls the least of these food or drink or clothes or whatever, you were doing it for me. And they get into the kingdom. And the ones that don't do that don't get into the kingdom. I wonder why he says that. Same thing. It's all the way through. 2 Timothy. Paul writes to Timothy so that Timothy will bring him his cloak before winter. By the way, Timothy, the house of Onesiphorus refreshed me often. Why? Why is he telling Timothy? Identify with me. Show me hospitality, identify with me, and by doing that, you identify with the message I've been entrusted. This is big. It's about identifying with the message of Messiah by showing hospitality to God's anointed. So in our text, the king says to his men, take this message. If they receive you, they'll refresh you. If they're on God's team, they'll refresh you. There are only two teams in this story. And there's enmity, right? From the beginning, from the very beginning. Seed of the woman, seed of the serpent. And there's enmity all the way through. He says, that's how you'll know. You guys will get along just fine. They'll take care of you. Verse 16. Jesus says, behold, I'm sending you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. So be shrewd as serpents and innocent as doves. The you here, of course, refers to the apostles. So the apostles are the sheep, but who are the wolves? Ah, Barb, you remember the Sermon on the Mount, don't you? That's right. Matthew 7:15. Beware of false prophets that come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. And of course, he's talking about the Pharisees. He's saying, look, I'm sending you out amongst the Pharisees. In Matthew 7, the wolves are the Pharisees. Now in Matthew 10, same group, same people, same words, same class. This is simple. We're just tracking along, following the story. I'm sending you out amongst these Pharisees. You got to be careful. Don't needlessly pick fights. They're going to try to trap you. They're going to try to kill you because they're trying to kill me. Verse 17. Beware of men, for they will hand you over to the courts and scourge you in their synagogues. But you will even be brought before governors and kings for my sake as a testimony to them and to the Gentiles. So the apostles are going to be mistreated, maligned, and imprisoned for Jesus' sake. Now that's Sermon on the Mount language too, isn't it? Blessed are those who were persecuted for the sake of righteousness. Blessed are you when you are persecuted for my sake. And we get a little foreshadowing here, because it's interesting. Verse 5, he said, do not go to the Gentiles. Now he's saying, when you go to Israel, they're going to persecute you as a testimony to them and to the Gentiles. So I'm going to tell you where this thing's going already. I'm sending you out. Don't be surprised when this happens later in the story. We're laying the foundation. Matthew's kind of tipping his hand as we're following him along in the story. Now, the question they're probably asking, this is a question we're going to find John asking in the next chapter. Jesus, you're the king. We're your people. We're supposed to be reigning with you. We're supposed to throw off Rome and be ruling this joint. Why would we be suffering? Why are the king's men suffering? He heads them off. Verse 24. A disciple is not above his teacher, nor a slave above his master. It is enough for the disciple that he become like his teacher, and the slave like his master. If they've called the head of the house Beelzebul, how much more will they malign the members of his household? If you would identify with me, and they hate me, they will hate you. Do not be surprised. This is par for the course. Now we're going to skip through this pretty quick because we're coming to the end, and I want you to get the main point here. Jesus is thrust in the passage what he's trying to get through to these guys. Comes in verse 32. Therefore, he's telling them, don't you fear men. Don't. And that was the problem, if you remember, all through the Old Testament story. Take Saul, for example. Saul feared the people. That got him in trouble. God says, you should have known not to fear the people. You fear God. I'm running this thing. And throughout the story, Israel fears the gods of the nations. He says, that's a mistake. See, the gods of the nations didn't put the curse on you, and the gods of the nations don't have the ability to remove it. They cannot deliver you. And now, if you're going to trust in them, who's going to deliver you from my hand? So he says, don't fear those who kill the body and unable to kill the soul. Don't fear. But no, verse 32, therefore everyone who confesses me before men, I will also confess him before my Father who is in heaven. But whoever denies me before men, I will also deny him before my Father who is in heaven. Now what do we call that? That is their fruit. You will know them by their fruit. Their fruit is their confession. Same story that's going all the way through. Now, this is an important thing you need to take with you. We know the disciples are 12 Jews who were eyewitnesses to Jesus' words and works. And his works, his words are Matthew 5 through 7. His works are chapters 8 through 9. These guys have special authority. They're able to demonstrate the validity of their message. Why do we care? Does that have any relevance for us? This side of the cross. These guys are going out to Israel trying to get them on board with the kingdom program. We know that's a train wreck. Why does this matter, or does it matter for us? Notice it. Verse 40. He who receives you receives me.
And he who receives me receives him who sent me. He who receives you receives me. Who is the you? The apostles. The disciples in this text. So the way that the people are going to receive Jesus is by receiving the apostles. And he who receives me receives him who sent me. Who sent Jesus? The Father. So the way that you receive the Father is through Jesus. So you go from the apostles to Jesus to the Father. That's how you get to God the Father. This is huge. Do not miss this. This will change everything. Can you get to the Father without Jesus? No. Can you get to Jesus without the apostles? Well, when he's walking around on earth, maybe. What about now? Listen to this. This is the Upper Room Discourse. John chapter 17. I'm just going to read a few verses. John chapter 17. This is Jesus giving his high priestly prayer before he exits the story. And he's praying for his apostles. Listen to what he says. Chapter 17, verse 7. Jesus speaking to God the Father of the apostles. Now they have come to know everything that you, the Father, have given me. Jesus is from you. For the words which you gave me, I have given to them, the apostles. And they received them and truly understood that I came forth from you, and they believed that you sent me. Now listen to this, verse 18. As you sent me into the world, I have also sent them into the world. Verse 20. I do not ask on behalf of these alone, the apostles, but for those who believe in me through their word. So what's going on here? The same word that the Father gave Jesus, you know, he doesn't come to speak on his own account, he comes to speak what the Father gives him. He gives that word to the apostles. That's the apostolic doctrine, the apostolic teaching. And as the Father sent Jesus, Jesus is leaving, and Jesus sends the apostles. Why? So that, verse 20, we might believe through their word. We believe in one holy, universal, and apostolic church. We, everyone in this room, came to believe through the apostolic word. Their eyewitness testimony to the words and the works of Jesus. Now, once you realize that this is the role of the apostles, when Israel rejects the message, the function of the king's men is going to be to take this message, their eyewitness testimony, to the nations so that the nations will believe, and then Israel will become jealous and then be saved. It's Deuteronomy 32. Because you've provoked me to anger and jealousy, the Lord said, right from the beginning, Moses says, I'm telling you this is what's going to happen. You guys are going off the track. You're a perverse and wicked generation. God says, because you provoked me to anger with that which was not a God, I'm going to provoke you to anger and jealousy with those who are not a people. I'm going to make you jealous so that you will be saved. That's the story. That's where this story is going. And once you realize that that's what's happening, this will change the way you read the New Testament. Because it's all through here. The role of the apostles, the apostolic authority. This is starting from here and carrying forward. 1 John. 1 John chapter 1, verse 3. What does John say? What we have seen, the apostles. What we have heard, we proclaim to you also. So that you too may have fellowship with us. And indeed, our fellowship is with the Father and with His Son, Jesus Christ. He's basically quoting this process. We're the ones who've seen Him. We heard Him. We're coming here to tell you all about it. You reject our message, good luck, but you got no chance. Zero. Who is the Antichrist but the one that denies that Jesus is the Christ? The one who thinks he has a relationship with God the Father without the Son. That guy's the Antichrist. He didn't have a relationship with the Father because the only way to the Father is through the Son. And if you don't want to know who the Son is, you better talk to somebody who's seen him and heard him. That's what's going on. That's where the story is moving. Now notice how he ends this. Verse 41. He who receives a prophet in the name of a prophet shall receive a prophet's reward. And he who receives a righteous man in the name of a righteous man shall receive a righteous man's reward. And whoever in the name of a disciple gives to one of these little ones even a cup of cold water to drink, truly I say to you, he shall not lose his reward. Now I read this and I ask, who are these little ones? The term is actually least ones. It's the same. It's the least ones, the little ones. Who are they? Well, notice, he's speaking to disciples. Whoever receives you receives me. And whoever receives me, of course, receives the Father. And then he does this little pattern. Someone, verse 41, receives a prophet in the name of a prophet. They get a prophet's reward. They receive a righteous man in the name of a righteous man, get a righteous man's reward. But in verse 42, notice, he switches things up. In the name of a disciple, gives to one of these least ones. It's backwards. In the context, what you're doing then is you're giving an apostle, a disciple, a drink of water because he's giving you the message of Messiah. The least ones are the disciples. In the name of the disciple, helps out a disciple, gets a disciple's reward. They won't lose their reward. And what is their reward? What's the reward of those who follow Jesus? Kingdom. You get the kingdom. Everlasting life in the kingdom. So in chapter 10, the righteousness of the Old Testament has arrived in Jesus. The king charges his men. He says, go out to Israel, tell them all about it. Tell them I'm here, see if they'll accept the message, and they'll take it to the Gentiles. Like Humpty Dumpty, though, we know Israel does not receive the message. Instead, they have a great fall. But unlike Humpty Dumpty, the king can put Israel back together. In the future, we expect that. He's going to put them back together. In the meantime, as we've spoken now, we know we get the message. We get the story. These 12 Jews go and do the function of the nation that's rejected him, rejected the king. It's like Kadesh Barnea. We've mentioned this before. Moses is trying to go into the land with the people. Everybody but Joshua and Caleb, they spot the land. Everybody says, we don't want to go into the land. Forget that. We'd rather go out into the wilderness. They separate themselves from the nation. That generation dies. Next generation raises up. Caleb and Joshua go into the land. The disciples separate themselves from the nation. The nation rejects the king. They stick with the king, so now they're doing the work of the king. They're taking that message, but now it's going, we're at Matthew 28 now. Go make disciples. He doesn't say, go preach the gospel of the kingdom. Repent, for the kingdom is at hand in the presence of the king who's walking around on earth. That's not our message, is it? The good news is the fact that now we get to participate in something that we never had. We didn't know about this at all. Ephesians 2, Paul's going to say, look, you Gentiles were hopeless. You were without hope and without God. You didn't know up from down. You didn't have the revelation of God. Israel's supposed to bring that to you. They didn't. But now you got it. How about that? And you got the Spirit too. You got the promises? Are you kidding me? What about Israel? No, they don't got it. They don't got the Spirit. They're still walking around trying to keep the law. Arguing with one another, fighting one another. It won't always be that way, though. Why? Because they know we got it. We got that message, the apostolic testimony. We've received it. We bring it back to them. Guys, you missed it. But you can still get in. It's waiting for you. The king's going to come back. You just got to accept it. Repent and return.